Hi, Kelvin Abraham.
Good evening or morning.
As Master of Tatrionics, we are doing these interesting conversations in which I occasionally pop up an idea of which I have not told you before what I would like to ask you about, because as a result, other people can see how you actually think about it and explore what I would call science in the making. And for now, I also have thought up a topic which I'd like to briefly introduce.
For sure.
So just like everybody else, you don't know what it is about anymore. So here comes the rabbit out of the hat. There is a topic called radioactivity, but there is also something called active radio. And there is also something called radiative spaces. And
right.
I would like to ask you to bring it all together. And I'll give you a bit of a thinking space while I elaborate a bit more while I ask you about this. Radioactivity is something that very many people have difficulty understanding. It has to do with, let's call it, the instability of atoms. And especially what happens when atoms are being pestered in laboratories or otherwise. The instability of some atoms is very well known. Thorium, uranium, and others. And some physical approaches have emerged which are basically using that kind of atomic decay to heat up water, to make steam, to turn a wheel, to create electricity, a sort of wasteful kind of technology. I'd like to connect that to something else people implicitly understand about that, which is that radioactivity is harmful to our body. People are very often unaware of it, and they get very confused by that, because doctors say, no, it's okay to hold your mobile phone against your head. You should not stick your head into the microwave oven, but it's okay to stick a microwave oven against your head.
Yes.
Because of the military interest in radar technology and the atomic bomb and the atomic energy, all of that got intermingled in a political, financial interest as well. As a result of which, the effect of radioactivity on the body is played down. And that I would like to connect. So I started with the radioactivity, then the radioactivity effect on the body, but I already implied that there is something called active radio. When you hold the microwave oven in miniature as the mobile phone against your head, it has effects because the cells already talk with each other using radio signals and electric and electronic communication. So active radio essentially in many ways is the same as radioactive. And you can see that also in these devices like HARP, the High Amplitude Auroral Research Project. Which is basically a very large radio mast, which essentially is just as toxic as the mobile phone mast just across the road for so many people. And especially so many of them are on top of the old age homes, which is some implied message in that. So the active radio, it is known that it is a concern, but it is very often denied. And the reason for that is the fourth element, which I would like to connect this up to, which is called the radiative spaces. And many people do not know about radiative spaces and radiative energies because the school books don't talk about the inventor of electricity, of the dynamic electricity, Nikola Tesla. But nevertheless, this was a guy who really created most of what we use in the electrical domain.
Absolutely.
And understood what happened, not only in the way it happens in nature, but also how it happens in the body. He was one of the first people to create ball lightning, and considered it trivial. But one of the fundamental ideas that he kept on referring to is radiative energy. And so would be the four elements which I would just like to toss on the table. And I ask you the question for the simple reason that in tetrionics you have come up with a quite different understanding of the fundamental subatomic constructs. In tetrionics you can actually model it. We already did an interview on how atoms can be understood in that perspective. And so my question now is basically another view on this view which you already presented on atomic structure, integrity and composition. But now let's call it addressing the instability and decay as it could play around with it, the atomic dynamics. Is this a surprising enough question for you?
Oh, it's I'm familiar with it. It's surprising. it's what I would term getting more into the quantum electrodynamics or electrical theory, which is obviously my background. And it was exciting for me to get into it and to begin to understand it, because like so many others taught from the top-down approach, I basically learned electrical theory rote style. It was as it was taught to me. I just simply developed a mental model of my own to explain how it works. A lot of people use water analogies for current and voltage and water pressure, things like that. Obviously with tetrionics I had this model of the atom that I could play with. I had the electrons as physical tangible tri-tetrion particles, if you like, and I had what was the model of the proton and the neutron, so I could build atoms. And I had to be able to explain electricity, which even to this day is very nebulous. Physics as it stands has a number of failings. First one is, and it relates directly to what we're talking about here, is it has no definition of what creates electrical charge. It models mathematically what its effects are via Coulomb's law, as in the law of attraction, which everyone's familiar with. Opposites attract, sames repel. But it has no explanation as to what the underlying physics of the creation of charge is and how it works, both electrically and magnetically. It just works. And here's the formula for it. This is how we apply it to work in electrical circuits and in nuclear energy. And to date, it's our best guess. You'll often hear it quoted that QED is the most accurate scientific theory ever developed, accurate to 12 decimal places. That's a marvelous accomplishment. If only the number they were calculating for was the right one. It's easy to get the right answer to 12 decimal places if you know the number to start with. The other thing that QED fails in is that it's got no understanding of the difference between mass and matter. This is what we touched on in the previous discussion, where we can show and teach children in their first week of school to differentiate between mass energy geometries and matter topology in physics. In doing that, with these triangles that the children are learning with, they can quickly learn what an electromagnetic field is, which is basically these charged Planck quanta sitting flat as a sheet. And all that happens is, if you imagine a point in space, not worrying about what the particle looks like, but just a point in space, and it's generating an electromagnetic field, there's just like a fan of triangular blades pointing out from that point in space, full of all these little plus and minus Planck quanta, as we discussed in the previous discussion that we had. Each side of these triangles of Planck energy have positive and negative charges. And these are modeled in physics as a sine wave or as energy. electromagnetic fields like what you find in the microwave oven, or like what's found in uranium. It's unstable, it emits energy. And energies, another one of these nebulous terms in modern physics. We have formulas for energy, we know what it does, we can describe it, we can show how it creates motion, how it stores energy, has different components, electric permittivity fields, magnetic permeability. It creates different things as described by Maxwell's laws. And we put them to use every day in nuclear power plants, in smoke detectors. But to this date, along with charge, mass, and matter, energy is a very nebulous concept in physics. We can describe it, as I said, we can predict its effects and what it will do and how it is stored. But because we have this current modern physics model that is top down, we have no real understanding of the mechanics that are at work and what's really going on. That all changes once you get familiar with tetrionic theory. And most of what I'm about to describe can be found in the second and third books. The radioactivity component of what I'm about to describe is covered in the chemistry books towards the end of chemistry. After I've given all the models of each and every periodic element, I then cover chemistry and nuclear fission. The radio side of things, radio fields, RF or EM fields, and the energies within them and the forms of energy are covered in the second book, QED, because that's what quantum electrodynamics and electrical theory is all about. It's about electricity and how these triangles make it all come about and how we can use this knowledge to tap into it to create forms of energy that we can then use, as in electricity. Just to touch on the radioactivity side of things, tetrionics, as I mentioned, gives us models of electrons, of atoms. In fact, it gives us models for every single element that's available. What it does, what becomes clear very quickly, is that the current model of radioactivity is hopelessly flawed. When you go to build elements larger than element 60 onwards using charge topologies with plus and minus charges making up each element, you run into an immediate problem, and that is that in order to build larger elements through the residual strong force or quark electric fields, where positive and negatives come together to hold the atoms together to form larger elements, at element 60 you run out of available or free neutrons, protons that will enable more neutrons to bind. For example, uranium-235 is actually element number 92. In the current model of physics, there's a the Z number, which is 92, represents how many protons and electrons are in that element. So in the case of uranium, they measure the mass of the uranium element and find that it's got the equivalent of 235 amounts of matter, to try and simplify it. And in that, they know that under the current model, 92 of them must be protons and there must be 92 electrons, leaving the need for to get the right mass, 143 neutrons have to be bound to those 92 protons. It's a physical impossibility. When you build the models, you find you, after element 60, you cannot physically add excess neutrons, as they're called, to make the model the right weight, the right mass, atomic mass. I had to sit down and think long and hard and follow the modeling that tetrionics had in order to find the solution to this problem. And again, this is where tetrionic geometry is the grammar of the math. The mathematics dictates that there should be 143 neutrons, but there physically cannot be. What you find is that using the tetrionic model, you find that periodic elements, all of them, are made up of deuterium nuclei, not hydrogen, with excess neutrons. So you have the current model of 92 hydrogen atoms with 143 neutrons packed around it somehow, suddenly becomes a model of 92 deuterium atoms of varying energy levels. Energy levels 1 to, I think, 6 in this case. And this is the crazy part. Since the 1950s, there's been a formula that was devised by Erwin Schrödinger to give us the quantum numbers to fit into a mathematical formula called Schrödinger's equation that mathematically models all the properties of any element. In the case of uranium that we're talking about at the moment, 235, the principal quantum number of uranium is 1 to 6. So it's been known, even Mendeleev's periodic table shows us that it has 6 atomic shells, 6 which relate to the 6 quantum numbers of Schrödinger's number. Tetrionics shows us that as you build up the 92 deuterium atoms to put together to form uranium, what happens is you have more and more more and more Planck quanta in each energy level. So in rough terms, energy level 1 has 1 triangle per charged fascia. Energy level 2 will have 4. Again, we're following the squared numbers of physics. Energy level 3 will have 9 triangles per charged fascia for the electrons and for the protons and neutrons. But what it does by having these energy levels and following tetrionic geometry is suddenly there is no excess neutrons. When you do the mathematics, we have simply 92 deuterium nuclei of 6 energy levels that come together to form uranium-235. What makes it radioactive is that the energy levels of the energy levels 1 through to 6 of the deuterium nuclei affect the energy levels of the electrons that bind to them. So if you have for example, a N1 deuterium nuclei, the electron that binds to it will spin at, say, a velocity of 1, for argument's sake. If that same electron bound to the N6 energy level, it would have a velocity of 6 and an energy of 36 compared to the energy of 1 for the N1. As you add more and more energy via the energy of the deuterium nuclei to these electrons, you reach a point where they spin faster and faster, and eventually they have enough energy to break away from the deuterium atom. When they do that, they become what are known as beta particles or accelerated electrons. They break away from the nuclei and they speed off in a set direction based on the direction of their chem fields. But that's what causes radioactivity. It's these principal energy levels that have been known since the 1950s, or since Mendeleev first designed his periodic table with atomic shells, these energy levels have been known, that creates the radioactivity. Because the more mass energy you have, or more triangles in the matter topologies of each element, the more energy is available to accelerate the electrons away, make them break free of the atom itself. in the case of uranium and plutonium and other elements like that, there's a lot of energy in the deuterium nuclei that are away from the center, away from the core of the nucleus. So they're very, not only do they have more energy, they're less tightly bound to the nucleus, so they can break away really easy. In some cases, even the deuterium nuclei themselves break away. When two of them break away, they shoot off like the electrons do, but one difference. You can put a test tube over the uranium or the radium, which is usually the case, and the two free deuterium nuclei will recombine to form helium. So you have alpha decay being present. Or in some cases, you can just release a lot of energy out of one of the deuterium nuclei as it tries to get to a lower stable energy level, and it will emit a gamma ray, which is just purely electromagnetic radiation. So using the deuterium model, firstly, we've gotten rid of the excess neutron problem. That's always been used as the current model and still is. That's no longer a problem, along with the binding problems that was present. Secondly, we now have a model of the atom that is accurate and matches Schrodinger's equation and Mendeleev's atomic shells. And we've matched up the principal quantum numbers to the atomic shells. We can also match up the azimuthal numbers to the location of electrons within radioactive elements, within all elements. We can also show the spin orientation of electrons and many other features of modern physics that the math is known for, but they're not unified. There's no understanding of the underlying mechanics to bring about this math and these results. That's all resolved in this process. But more importantly, what we find using this model, apart from the alpha, beta, and gamma decays, is that Einstein's equation of E equals mc squared, which is often quoted for the reason why we get the energy out of the atom, is correct, but has been misinterpreted. It is a equivalence formula. It simply equates the amount of mass in a field to the energy content of the field. In the case of radioactive decay, E equals mc squared is incomplete. What you need to fully understand it is an understanding of how the energy of matter, not mass, is being converted. And that's it's the symmetric counterpart. It's m divided by c squared to give you the right energy levels. Again, a misinterpretation of the math, because the underlying geometry of the physics was unknown. So we have a situation here where Einstein's equivalence formula, while correct, is not really giving us the mechanics. All deuterium nuclei are in fact what I term quantum synchronous converters. That is, they can absorb energy that's put into them in the form of light being shone on them, or heat being applied to them. They convert that energy and they store it within their charge topologies as mass. That is the mass energy conversion that is going on. What's missing is the fact that that mass is being stored in a matter topology, which is the shape of the deuterium or the uranium atom itself. When you look at deuterium nuclei in terms of a electromagnetic component, anyone familiar with electrical engineering will quickly recognize them as quantum synchronous converters, which means that they can store the energy that interacts with them in the form of mass, and they can release that excess mass, energy levels 1 to 8, by spinning electrons up to higher and higher energy levels so that they either emit spectral lines or the electron itself jumps out of the nucleus and forms beta decay. So that's how radioactivity comes about. There are, it's fully explained and in a lot more detail in my ebooks than what I just went through there, but I was trying to carefully step you through the basics of fission, or more importantly of mass energy storage and release in radioactive elements, and how the current model with excess neutrons is completely wrong in many, many respects, and how in fact deuterium, not hydrogen, is the building block of all elements, and their differing energy levels of the deuterium atoms is what brings about radioactivity. You can, if you like, think of the different energy levels, which are all color-coded, as being like campfire coals. The hotter the coal, the brighter it burns at different colors. And all we've done to make an element like uranium is to get six different campfire coals of different energies and stack them on top of each other like a children's toy top. That's all uranium is. When we get a lot of these toy top uranium elements together, it obviously creates more heat. It causes more electrons to fly off because it's hotter, and we use that heat to boil water. We do it in the confines of a nuclear reactor, and that's all it does. We put enough uranium in there so that it heats the water to drive a turbine. And then after a while, you find that it is no longer able to heat the water as efficiently, and then we have waste fuel rods. So they get taken out and new fuel rods get put in, just like stoking the campfire, putting fresh fuel in to make it hotter. That's all we're doing. It's just an advanced version of that. That's radioactivity. Not in so much of a nutshell, but that's the basics of it. And that's covered in chemistry, in the chemistry ebook towards the end. Fission itself is simply, in the case of a runaway reaction, a nuclear bomb, is simply where some energy in the form of a neutron and its chem field are added to this atom, and the addition of energy makes it unstable, where some of the deuterium nuclei or the electrons go to higher energy levels. They then want to lose that energy and drop back down, and in the process, along with the physical shape of the uranium atom, which is in the books, you can make your own models, or you can just look at the illustrations in the book or play with the 3D models we've made. You'll see that uranium itself has a unique shape, like a dumbbell, where the core electrons, or the core of it, are at the center of the dumbbell, and it's prone, if you have enough energy, to be broken. It will split into two half dumbbells, and in the process of doing that, it shatters, for lack of a better word. It's like firing a bullet at a dumbbell, and the dumbbell is made of ice, and it just shatters into all these pieces. When it shatters, all these different energy level deuterium nuclei want to lose this excess energy, and N8 wants to become N1 so it can be happy and lose all this extra heat. It loses that heat in the fraction of a second, and that causes the same effect in nearby uranium atoms, and it begins a uncontrolled chain reaction. I've given all the pictures breaking down for the decay particles. I've given the energy released figures in my work in the ebooks. I won't bore you with the details here, but it's all available in the books. It all marries up, And as I said, it's done via a completely different model to what the current model of fission and atomic models themselves of elements currently is, which again gave me more confidence in my work. But to now move on to the radioactive or the radio wave side, radiant energies. These are the same energies that are contained as mass within uranium. As I said before, when you shine or input energy into a quantum synchronous converter, the energy is stored in a number of ways. It could be stored as mass under E equals mc squared in the charge topology of the elements themselves, which just raises their energy levels. But again, it has to be added so as to form squared numbers or to fit into the equilateral geometries. So that's one way of storing the energy. The other way to store energy, if it's not a huge amount of energy, is to make the electron that acts as a rotor in the synchronous converter. It just makes the electron spin faster. So you add energy of the right frequency, because again, you have to make squared energy levels. You shine the right light onto the atom, the electron will receive the right amount of energy and it will spin at the next higher energy level. This is what creates the photoelectric effect. If you shine the wrong color, you don't have the right number of quanta under Planck's formula, E equals nh nu squared. You need a certain odd number of quanta to make the electron spin at the next velocity. So Planck discovered the basics. Einstein then said, in order to create the reason for this photoelectric effect, is that, as Planck said, photons come in quanta. Specific quanta will make the electron spin faster, but if you've got the wrong quanta, no matter how much of it you have, it won't do the quantum jump or won't go to the next velocity. That was Einstein's contribution that gave him the Nobel Prize. What tetrionics does is gives you the geometry, and again, the QED book has probably 50 illustrations on all the possible spectral line colors, frequencies, and energies. It has the mathematics and the geometry that gives the mathematics, all explained in the QED book. But it's all equilateral geometries and additions of odd numbers or subtraction of odd numbers that accelerates the electron to give us what Bohr described as quantum jumps or quantum leaps. While the electron is bound to the atom, it can only change in these specific energy levels. Once it's free, it can change any energy level, but while it's bound, only specific changes can occur. So using this model, we now explain spectral lines, all the colors that we see, every single color, plus heat and gamma rays. We explain Rydberg's formula, which has been known for two centuries now. The formula works mathematically, but no one's ever been able to explain it. Tetrionics explains it with the geometry of equilateral energies. And we also now have a basis to show that mass or excess mass, higher energy levels of deuterium nuclei, directly affects the rotation speed of bound electrons. And that's important because that was the beginning of radio transmissions. When the photoelectric effect was first discovered, we were creating radio waves using spark gaps. The Titanic had spark gap radios. Spark gaps, I'm trying to think of the professor's name. Faraday's professor, who's famous in his own right, and his name eludes me at the moment. Humphrey.
Helmholtz.
No, Humphrey.
Oh.
Humphrey was the first one to create electromagnetic induction, which Faraday mathematically developed and explained. He was known for discharging batteries and voltaic piles, discharging them via a spark and creating sparks at different places in the building, wherever brass bolts were in the building and things like that. That was the creation at that time of electromagnetic waves. Maxwell, Faraday wrote up his laws, combined them with Gauss's and Lenz's laws into Maxwell's equations as they're known. Another professor who eludes me at the moment, I should know all this better, then issued one of, might have been Helmholtz actually, issued his class a challenge to detect these waves. And Heinrich Hertz was the first to detect them. And they've since come to be known as Hertzian waves or Maxwell's transverse waves. The interesting part about the story now develops that at the same time, another gentleman by the name of Nikola Tesla was introducing us to AC technologies, which he invented, to give us the ability to transmit electrical power great distances and to turn electrical motors. When Heinrich Hertz discovered these transverse waves, he wrote up his thesis and announced his discovery. Tesla heard of the discovery and went over and actually spent quite a bit of time with him, showing him what he'd discovered, because he was convinced that what he'd discovered as transverse waves was in fact not transverse waves, because Tesla's research had been along the lines of what he called longitudinal waves. And a lot of his work had been done with spark gap discharges. This is where history and maths conspired to delay our development of humanity by a century. Tesla had the practical experience. He showed his results to Hertz, who immediately became a bit depressed about what Tesla had shown him and was almost ready to withdraw his thesis paper. Eventually, his friends convinced him that no, he was right, to ignore what Tesla had shown him and explained and proceed anyway. And the waves that he discovered came to be known as Maxwell's transverse waves. The irony of it was that what he had discovered were longitudinal waves. Now, I won't go into detail here, but basically there's a 90-degree phase difference between longitudinal waves and transverse waves. If you think of it this way, and there's pictures in my ebook again showing Tesla and Hertz either side of a page with waveforms in there. They look like a cross made of diamonds. The up and down diamond is the transverse wave described by Maxwell's equations and used in modern radio communications. The left to right diamond shape is a longitudinal wave. There's a 90-degree phase change between the two. They're identical as far as their diamond shape and the fact that they're made up of equilateral EM or Planck quanta, E equals H nu or E equals HF. Should be H nu squared in reality, but that's another story where maths again is incorrect in detail, correct in generality, but incorrect in detail and needs to be corrected. This is where Einstein enters the picture. We now have longitudinal, left to right, and transverse waves, up and down, that move electrons in different ways, all because of the linear momentum that's within the equilateral Planck triangles that make up the waves. And remember again that the linear momentum of an equilateral energy is simply the height, the bisector line. of the equilateral Planck energy itself, of the scalar geometry. Again, that's in the pictures and it's explained in QED in a much great detail. But what Einstein showed with the photoelectric effect harks back to only odd number quanta being able to accelerate these electrons when they're bound in the nuclei. Planck had discovered that that electromagnetic energy was quantized, which was the birth of quantum mechanics. Einstein showed that the reason why specific colors had to be used to excite them was that those colors, those odd numbers, specific odd numbers, were required to fit in, if you like a key fitting into a lock. Only specific odd number quanta could make the electron jump to the next energy level. What they wanted in radio communications was a way to transmit signals more efficiently. The original spark gaps that we were talking about originally, where electrical discharges were sent out between, were pulsed like Morse code, which is where Morse code was invented. As they pulsed the Morse code key, the sparks would be generated. They propagate through the air and cause sparks to appear at a distant receiving station, and you decode the sparks to get the message. When Einstein discovered the photoelectric effect and got the Nobel Prize, it was because if you shone ultraviolet light on these spark gaps, it was easier to generate the sparks themselves using different materials. So it became quicker and quicker, and less energy was required to generate further. We quickly developed the technology. Instead of using spark gaps, we moved to a solid state situation where through capacitors and inductors, we created oscillators and solid state oscillators with transistors. So we no longer used the spark gap that Tesla was familiar with and what he'd shown and what Hertz had been using. We moved away from the spark gaps and moved to solid states with the photoelectric effect and with LC oscillation circuits. By moving to these circuits, we effectively stopped using spark gaps. So the left to right longitudinal waves were no longer used. In fact, the only place they then appeared was in the commutator brushes of DC motors. And we quickly put quench circuits on them to get rid of these sparks because they were seen as troublesome and not of any use, because occasionally they'd actually send voltages back into the generators and dynamos and blow them up. So we went out of our way to stop longitudinal waves being developed, and we went to transverse waves. In my illustrations, I show that the transverse waves, the up and down diamond, the linear momentum of those waves cause electrons at the far end to oscillate. As per electrical theory with sine waves, you generate changing voltages at one end, the radio wave propagates in a sine wave, or the energy propagates, and at the far end at the antenna, an electron moves up and down in sympathy with this wave that's being received. We then amplify these electrons that are in up and down motion, and we decode that at the far end as electrical, as radio waves or as TV signals. That's the basis of our technology at the moment. We're using transverse waves as per Maxwell's theory. What Maxwell's theory doesn't show is that 90 degree wave that's generated by disruptive spark gaps, the waves that Tesla was playing with, because Tesla discovered that when he discharged his batteries in Leyden jars, that he felt these rays that he called stinging rays. He knew they weren't electrons because he was familiar with the work of Crookes and the work that he'd done on electrodes and cathode ray tubes. He knew they weren't electrons, so he set off to work out what they were. And his term for this left to right field, which I called longitudinal waves, he called radiant energy. He also called them longitudinal waves. And the reason why I still prefer the term longitudinal wave is that the linear momentum of these waves, despite being exactly the same as a transverse wave, has a very peculiar property. When rotated 90 degrees, so it goes left to right, instead of oscillating an electron up and down, as the up and down transverse waves do, longitudinal waves apply a direct force on electrons and move them physically left to right. So instead of oscillating an electron, they physically push them along left to right, just like a pool cue. When you line it up and you go tap, the electron moves. The big advantage of this is that, firstly, it's more efficient so far as the transfer of energy, but secondly, it can actually, what it actually does is it causes all the linear momentum to line up like little arrows and form a large pool cue. Very rough analogies, but again, it's all explained in my work. And you can create a situation that's been observed by Wheatstone 2 centuries ago now, where you can actually transfer information to remote distances faster than light. Relativity says that you can't do this, that it's impossible, but through basic physics, basic geometry, I can now show that faster than light communication or transfer of information over any distance is a practical reality. So that was the basis of Tesla's radiant energy. All of the modern technology that we find today in microwaves, baby monitors, cellular phones, work on solid-state devices and produce transverse waves, which means they move the electrons in matter that they encounter up and down. And this harks back to Otto's earlier statement when we started the discussion, which was, it's okay to microwave your food, and it's still okay to put the cellular phone beside your ear. Couple things in play here. First thing is the microwave oven is shielded for the most part, or it should be, unless it's old or the way it seals is broken, or your microwave creator is actually damaged in some way. Always good to have them checked. But a new functional microwave should be sealed, and you should have minimal radiation coming out of it. It's about 2.5 gigahertz it runs on. It'll cook the food, and it does that by the radio waves that it creates, entering the food itself, the matter, and moving the electrons up and down. This up and down motion of the electrons is accelerating, decelerating them. When you decelerate an electron, it has to lose the energy that it got. So this up and down motion from the microwave inside the oven or entering the oven turns into heat within the oven itself. It also causes water molecules to vibrate backwards and forwards, oscillate. And they in turn, as they accelerate and decelerate, have to give off heat. That's what cooks the food very efficiently inside the microwave. The same sort of technology applies to your mobile telephones. When they transmit, I forget what the exact numbers are. I should have known. I learned all this. But anyway, they transmit, and that energy broadcasts out in all directions and goes into your head. Despite what some people will try and assure you, the radiation most certainly is entering your head just as much as it's reaching out to the radio tower. The phones are safe insofar as the receive side, because it's all the power. Without getting into the complexities of cellular network communication, basically your phone sits in standby mode until the base stations transmit a signal looking for it. When it gets that signal, it briefly powers up and says, "Here I am." That sends out a signal which also goes into your head. So that's its broadcast side. That's the side you really don't want going into your head for extended periods, because it will cause cancer. Cancer is nothing more than the body's cells receiving extra energy. As I said earlier with radioactivity, what happens when you get too much energy or excess energy being received by any atom? The atom can either spin up an electron and try and spit it out, or it can store that energy in the form of matter. If you have enough energy of the right type, you will have biological cells receiving just the right energy they want to begin rampant growth. And that's all cancer is. You've had a group of cells that have received enough energy to kickstart them so that they can then grab their own blood supply, have the energy they need to keep growing. And while you have that phone to your head, making and receiving phone calls and doing all the rest, you're giving it a supply of energy. As it gets bigger and larger, it'll eventually tap into the blood cells, the blood veins of your body, and develop its own way of getting energy, which is simple as every other cell in your body. It's directly from you. But this is the source of cancers. Not everyone will get them. It's down to how long the exposure is against the side of your head, what type of phone you've got, and your own susceptibility to how you can absorb and release the radiation itself. It's not as simple as they make out. It's, again, the same sort of story that you'll get everywhere else, where there's lies and statistics and things involved in engineers. And you also have to bear in mind that there are hugely vested interests in keeping people using phones and buying the latest and greatest and using the technology that we have. But it wouldn't be hard to plot the growth of cancers, and particularly facial cancers, to our growth of cell phone usage, and in fact the growth of cancer itself as a human ailment, to the growth of our electrical technologies, and the fact that we are now swamping our environment where we live with oscillation transverse fields, where microwave ovens, TV, plasma TVs, computers, anything electrical is generating a field, and all these fields are adding up, and we're walking through them and sleeping in them, using them every day. It's a insane irony that microwave ovens were invented when an engineer noticed that his Mars bar, or his lunch, I can't remember which, was melting when it was placed in front of the radio dish where he worked at the telecommunications company. And he discovered that if he used that radio, that RF frequency, that he could invent the microwave oven. And that telecommunication engineers like myself are constantly warned about the dangers of ambient RF radio frequency fields, but the general public aren't, because they're an ends to a means. They allow our modern way of life. They allow us to communicate easily with everyone at the drop of a hat, no matter where we are, to find things, to cook our meals, to turn on lights when it's dark, to do all the things that we take for granted in modern technology, while at the same time, we have to, well, we don't have to, but at the same time, we're being told that it's the only solution, that in order to have all these technologies, we need to just accept that we're living within these fields and they have no effect. Our body, and in fact our soul, our conscious soul, is an electromagnetic field. It is affected by other external electromagnetic fields. And if you doubt that, there are researchers in place, and you'll find them on the web, where you can put a very strong magnetic field against your brain, and you'll find that suddenly you can't say words, you can't remember things, your body reacts in very strange and uncontrollable ways, because you no longer, you've disrupted the electromagnetic connection between your conscious body, your conscious soul, and your brain, which is no more than a processor. You disrupt that, you have no control. you won't have access to memories or to thoughts. You won't be able to recall things that you can without the magnetic field around. What's the solution? Because we're ever more dependent on RF fields and radios and our modern way of life, when in fact what we're doing is slowly making our environment more and more RF active or radio frequency active than we should be. The solution is to fall back to what Tesla gave us a century ago now, which we discarded in preference for a mathematical understanding of physics, relativity, and the photoelectric effect. We have to fall back to spark gap discharges and longitudinal waves, because longitudinal waves, as Tesla pointed out, pass through us harmlessly, firstly. Secondly, they don't create oscillations of electrons in our body. They simply move electrons if they encounter them in a straight line. And with discharge technologies or radiant energy technologies, we can create a energy field that is of one type that won't affect us biologically, but at the same time will be able to deliver unlimited amounts of electrical energy, or horsepower as Tesla called it, to any point within that field. Tesla's understanding was rudimentary. I've taken his work and gone a step further again, purely because I have the geometry. What Tesla had in practical experimental evidence, I've now backed up in theory, which he couldn't do. Because Tesla couldn't explain his work, his practical work, with theory, everyone moves scientifically to Einstein's explanation and to solid state electronics, which we have now, to transverse waves. And we've literally ignored an entire field of electromagnetic wave energy generation and propagation that we can now slowly move our current technologies back over to. And in the process, we will get rid of all the electromagnetic fields that are bringing on childhood leukemia, causing tumors on the brain, in the face, that are causing all sorts of problems for people sleeping. We can get rid of overhead power transmission lines where they are forced to have easements and they produce huge magnetic fields. We can do away with all of those things, and we can in fact do away with coal-fired power stations and nuclear power itself and move to a cleaner, endless supply of energy, which simply utilizes the same energy process that the stars use, and that's the conversion of matter itself, i.e. converting deuterium nuclei or any form of matter back into the energy that it contains under E equals MC squared. But in doing this, what we do is we get rid of all the pollution, both physical environmental pollution as in radioactive stockpiles, and the immaterial pollution that we're not even presently aware of, as in radio waves and things that cause cancer. We remove that from our environment. So we can, by having an understanding of the underlying geometry and building from the bottom up for physics and electricity, we can eliminate a lot of our current problems, in particular the radioactive side of things that we've been talking about here. Again, it's all covered in all my ebooks, and I can go into a lot more detail on any aspects of anything I've discussed here. How's that go, Otto?
Well, I'm glad I asked you the question. Ask a question, get an answer. it's wonderful. You bring it all together. Theory. Yeah,
and that's what my theory should do.
Yeah, there's. I already see that I will have a further question at some point, which will then not be a surprise question, which I can spring on you. But there is what you described is something which connects back to what we talked about in the Tetrionics understanding of atomic coherence. which you now addressed at the relationship between the deuterium and the electron orbits around that.
Right.
But that will be for another question session.
Certainly, it's a few pages of the book, and it'll take a while to explain it.
So if you're okay with that, we could pick that up some other time. I think it would be wonderful to leave your explanation as is for now. Also, again, we have a near perfect 1 hour recording for this. And I'm really glad that you brought together had this understanding of active radio and radioactive, plus also to the clarity of showing how the longitudinal and the transverse wave model and the misunderstandings involved basically put our technology on the wrong route. And I liked that you summarized it as, well, the one had a theoretical model and the other did not, and now the top-down theoretical model that was is complemented by the bottom-up tetrionic theoretical model, which basically shows us what you said in the whole equilateral triangle philosophy, that you're able to see how opposites complement each other. So,
well, I felt it had to be done. Obviously, I needed to develop it if it truly was a unified theory, but I needed not only to build on my own model of equilateral triangles in a unified sense to bring in electricity, but it wasn't just a case of here's how I see it working. I had to explain what Maxwell and Hertz and Einstein and Gauss and Faraday and Tesla had all discovered. I had to show how all their discoveries actually work using this model, because it's not a case of, at the moment we have a fractured scientific community. We have a group of physicists who say this is how it is using transverse waves, but we also have a group of experimenters out there that are producing results that just can't be explained using Maxwell's model or even Heaviside's laws and things like that, quaternions. Can't explain it. Even Tesla's work can't explain some of it. We've got this fractured divide between the theoretical and the experimental. What my theory had to do was bridge both those fields and bring them back together and say, it's not a case of one being right at the expense of the other. It's a case of both of them being right in certain areas and wrong in other areas. And this is what the reality is, or i.e. the geometric reality that drives all their observations.
It's wonderful. Thank you very much. And I think this will be an excellent moment to round off this recording. As usual, I'll come back to you in a moment and close the recording now. Thank you very much for it.
No problems, Otto.